between you. He couldn't have done what you've done.
You need to take charge as soon as you get out.
I want him in charge.
No, I don't trust him.
He gets out after 3 years and you just hand everything over to him?
I'm back.
We're speaking with Stephen McCallum, the director of the new feature film 1%. Congratulations on the film. I've just seen it and it is a really intense 90 plus minutes.
Oh, cool. Good. Thanks, Phil. Yeah, that's certainly what we intended. So I'm glad to see that had the effect that we desired. Nice.
Well, the film's all about a motorcycle club, the Copperheads, and the power struggle between the president, Nuck, played by Matt Nable, and his right-hand man, Paddo, played by Ryan Kaur. And it was also written by Matt Nable. How did you get involved in the project? What was the first thing you saw?
Matt and I had met about a year earlier on a TV series called Gallipoli, where I was second unit director. So I knew of Matt, I'd met Matt. But the project came to me through producer Michael Ponson, who I went to film school with in Sydney at Afters. And he really loved the short film I did there, which was set in a colonial convict prison called Six Straws. And when he read Matt's script, he thought I'd be a great fit for bringing a real kind of tribal, visceral kind of aesthetic and authentic performance to the piece. I read the script and I really liked it. And Michael was right. I really connected to a lot of the themes that were in the script. At its heart, it's a story about a man that has to choose between his brother and his father, which is something I really, really connected with. And I really was intrigued by the world of outlaw motorcycle clubs. It's something I've been intrigued with and interested in for a long time. So the chance to do my first film in that sphere was something I couldn't turn down.
So, talking about the motorcycle clubs as a subject, the stuff you filmed, how did you make that authentic?
Yeah, I mean, that was something I really, had to focus on from the get-go. The script was originally kind of set in the 70s and a little bit more straightforward, and I really wanted to bring out the more tribal Shakespearean themes and modernise it. And the first step with anything, really, is always research. So, I watched every documentary I could, read every book. But the main thing was actually meeting these guys face-to-face and talking to current and ex-members of outlaw motorcycle gangs.
All right. Well, how long did that go on for, sort of a year or so?
Yeah, I mean, it was an ongoing process over about a year in development where Matt and I, the script that I initially saw was very different to the film we made. It was initially kind of a gang film. Multiple different gangs vying for power, and I knew we just didn't have the money to make that, and so did the producers, and we really discussed, could we put all the conflict in one club and then really make it more of a Shakespearean story of ambition and betrayal and father versus son, and more importantly, bringing out the female characters.
How did you work out from what you were told how you were going to make things, I guess, look and sound?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question because really, ultimately, what I did was I chose different aspects from multiple different clubs and multiple different people. So I had a particular vision in mind for what I wanted the club to feel and look like. And so I just borrowed from, multiple resources and melded it together. There's tribal influences from Zealand, and then there's more military aspects, like where you draw from like the Concheros or the Mongols as well. So yeah, it was really just an amalgamation. I wanted to create my own world, my own club.
And did you have any of your research subjects on set as advisors at any point?
Yeah, we did. We had a member, an ex-member on set as a military advisor, really, for lack of a better word. Whilst every club's different, there are certain things that members do and protocols they follow, like any organisation or any cult or any, religion, really, that feel authentic. So he was really a wonderful resource in making it happen. He saw it actually at the Sydney premiere, which was great, and he was just really blown away and thankful for how much it felt like a to him. So yeah, that was rewarding.
So it felt pretty real to him.
Yeah, he thought it was great. He was over the moon.
Did you ever?
I'm sure it won't to everybody. You know, every club is different, and you know, we're telling a story. It's not a documentary. So yeah, we'll see. I'm sure some, like when Romper Stomper came out, I remember, you know, Current Affair articles and stuff like that, where they got skinheads to watch the film, and they came out and they were furious, saying, you know, you've completely bastardized our subculture, and that's going to happen. But you know, we've tried to be faithful to the story and the world we've created.
Did you ever have a sort of an interesting moment where your advisor sort of pointed out something like, that would never happen?
Yeah, quite a few times. You know, not so much on set. On set, he was great. But there were some things where he was like, this wouldn't happen. I'm like, yeah, but mate, you know, we're telling a story. He was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. That would happen in another club. Oh, and, you know, when I was on Gallipoli, we had similar things with the military advisors there. You know, they had to work with us to be able to convey the story visually, you know, with it, because you're always trying to convey story beats within a condensed time frame, and sometimes you have to take liberties. But on screen, you know, that works. Whereas in reality, it sometimes doesn't. That's filmmaking.
So you're getting, you're doing the research, you're getting all that stuff nailed. But as you've said several times, you're telling a story. In fact, you use the word Shakespearean, which is good, because that was in my question, which was this. Alongside Matt Nable and Ryan Kaur's characters, you've got Simone Kessel and Abby Lee. And both those women have a sort of, in their characters, they have a kind of a Lady Macbeth feel. What was your thinking there?
Yeah, well, I mean, when I first read Matt's script, I saw that connection straight away. But I saw it as a real house divided story, you know, succession and ambition and betrayal, like I said before. And essentially, I saw the two female characters. I was like, we have an opportunity here to have two Lady Macbeths in one story, which I thought would be really fascinating. So, yeah, we worked hard in development to elevate that, and that was something that, you know, a lot of people comment on. It's definitely, you know, designed like that. I just felt, you know, the reason I connected to, I'm by no means a Shakespeareophile or anything like that, but I connect to those stories because they're just so, like, visceral and uncompromising in the lengths people go to for ambition, and I thought that resonated in this tale.
Well, in fact, there is so much about people fighting for power. Is that something that you've just drew out of this particular story? Is that actually a bigger theme you see often all around? Is that a big subject for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I always get attracted to in stories. Like, you know, some of my favorite films, like There Will Be Blood, and you know, where it's definitely, it's, you know, power belongs to those strong enough to hold it, and I feel that this had those aspects as well. So I really wanted to elevate that. And I think when you do that, you know, it really makes the story a bit more universal. I mean, I'm by no means, you know, fascinated by bikie gangs. I'm fascinated by subculture, and I'm fascinated by wanting to belong to something bigger than yourself, and the cost and the rewards for that. And ultimately, in most cases, whether it's in business, you know, or a cult, it's all about power, and power corrupts. And I found those aspects really interesting. And for me, that's what the story's about. It just happens to be in a bikie club. It could be any other sort of organization.
It's interesting because the family part of that, the idea that if I'm not in the club, I'm not in my family and my tribe, you really made that clear, that the loss of that was a big, big thing for these characters.
Oh, great. I mean, that's really important to me. And I think that's part of the thing with the film as well. I mean, you very rarely exit out of the four walls of the club. You know, there's not really any outside characters, and it really does feel like a little world that they're in. And to be banished from that means everything to them. And that's something that we drew from real life as well in terms of clubs. You know, these clubs really do operate as a family for people that don't have one. And it means a lot to them. And to lose your colours is the worst punishment you can have. So, yeah, it felt like being exiled from a kingdom. I often say, you know, this could have been set a thousand. If this was set 1,000 years ago, these guys would have been kings. In today's society, they're outlaws. So I saw as much resonance with that sense of belonging in, you know, like tribal Scotland or, you know, medieval Europe or anything like that.
Why are the Copperheads a 1% club?
As in, what does the term 1% mean?
Yeah, I wasn't able to work it out. So it's my problem, I
guess.
So
1% is a code name used by cops to refer to outlaw motorcycle clubs. So it harks back to a time of the Hells Angels, where a newspaper article in a motorcycle newspaper claimed that outlaw motorcycle clubs only made up 1% of motorcycle riders in America. And of course, these guys being who they are, decide to wear that as a badge of honor, literally as a patch on their vest. So outlaw motorcycle clubs wear 1% as a badge of honor to show that they're above the law.
Right. You also seem to have, talking about the view on motorcycle clubs, you also seem to have something going on in the story where Nuck represents kind of an older idea of what a club can be, whereas Pato presents a newer idea. Was that part of what you wanted to bring forth as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even down to the way they dress, Pato's in a relatively new model biker jacket, and Nuck's got one that he's been wearing for 20 years, and that's a real division that happens in most clubs. In fact, most conflict, kind of like as in most conflict in most organizations, is the old and the new, and the old bull and the new bull going head to head over progress, and one wanting to stay where they are, but you can't, and the young buck coming in and saying, well, we need to move forward to survive. And and that has been that's something that happens in real clubs, with the clubs becoming more monetized and becoming more business minded. Whereas the old school bikers, it's a place to kind of, you know, run amok and go on runs and have parties. Whereas modern clubs are more business orientated. They get called Nike bikies by older club members.
Do they really?
I mean, we tried to make the younger biker members look pretty cool in terms of their aesthetic, but there's a real kind of, you know, Louis Vuitton kind of aspect to some of the younger members that are in charge of bike clubs these days.
The monetization was really interesting, because Pato couldn't understand why Nuck wouldn't see money as the most important thing, and clearly Nuck did not.
Yeah, well, I mean, it comes from a couple of different things, I think, there as well. It's like Pato's leadership and Nuck's leadership are vastly different. Pato's more of a provider. He tries to empower his men and wants only the best for the club, whereas Nuck wants the club to be the representation of who he is. He likes to rule by an iron fist. Everybody does what he says, and those two philosophies come pretty much head to head as soon as he gets released from prison. And you know, which of course gets in the way of him trying to save his brother. So quite a few different sort of dynamics there. But it is, ultimately it is a story of father and son.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, Matt Nable, I thought it was interesting, because Matt Nable and Aaron Peterson, in fact, both seemed a little different to maybe what we are used to seeing. Are you, when you do something like this, are you aware of trying to get something different from actors, or do you just approach it by what's in the script and what the characters need?
No, I mean, I'm always, I guess ultimately it is always character driven, but different directors will connect to different aspects and want to make the characters as interesting as possible. At least I do. So I'm always looking for my actors to surprise me. And, right. You know, with Nuck, it really was a man that on the surface is ruling with an iron fist, but is, you know, when you watch the film, you realize that he's actually dealing with a lot of internal confusion, about who he is as a person. And he's actually kind of one of the most vulnerable characters in the film.
Yeah.
And then Sugar, Aaron Peterson's character, I kind of just wanted to see something that I hadn't seen before in an outlaw motorcycle world, which was somebody that's incredibly charismatic and conniving. I guess that came a bit more from the Shakespearean aspect as well.
Right.
I just wanted to make the characters as interesting and layered as possible.
Well, Abby Lee's got a pivotal role. What was there about her when she was cast to be Katrina? What quality were you seeing?
Yeah, well, so Katrina's an interesting character because she's got the biggest arc, I suppose, of any of the characters, or the biggest surprise, and you don't want to pick it straight away, but at the same time, you want to believe that she could be part of this world. So for me, when I chatted to Abby about the role, you know, she was really excited about potentially coming on board, but I just felt she had a real presence and mystery about her that I felt was right for the role, and also a counterpoint to Simone Kessel's character Hayley, who was very much the archetype loyal club matriarch. And you know, I wanted to see what a real Lady Macbeth character put in against head to head with this character would look like. Again, it was trying to find two opposites of the spectrum, as we did with Shadow and Nuck.
And there's plenty of, as I said earlier, there's plenty of intensity in this. What, how did you go about what seemed like it could be a super intense shoot? How did you deal with that?
It was tough, but at the same time, I mean, the intensity that's on screen is what happened on the day. Like, we were all committed to being as uncompromising as possible, and from the actors through to the crew to try and, I mean, most of the takes that are filmed was done in long takes, so that it felt really visceral and unpredictable. As a result, a lot of the actors got quite banged up, you know, in some of the fight scenes and things like that. But we needed that real intensity and unpredictability for it to feel real, and that was something we were all committed to from the get-go. I think it reads on the screen, which you know, most people come out of the cinema feeling like they need to get their breath back after the film, which is good. And I think that only really happens if you shoot with that type of intensity. But at the same time, we all had a great time on the weekends. You know, we're all friends once the camera stopped rolling, but everybody was very committed on the day.
Well, why was Western Australia the ideal location for the film?
Yeah, so Western Australia, I grew up in Western Australia, and I just, you know, growing up, bikie culture is such a massive part of Western Australian identity. You know, as a kid, you're told about the bikie clubs and they're referred to like the boogeyman. And I just felt I wanted to also show an aspect where I grew up. Whenever I see Perth on screen, it's usually, you know, blue skies and beaches. And, you know, that's not the area of Perth I grew up in. And I've always wanted to show, you know, what's this place look like 10 kilometres away from the coast, and that's where the film's set.
Well, that certainly came across in this. It was great seeing those parts, which, just as you say, we hardly ever get to see on screen. Anyway, thanks very much for your time. I know you've got to move on and do another interview. We really appreciate your time, Stephen. We hope for the best for the film when it goes into wide release.
Oh, thanks, Phil. No, I appreciate it. And, you know, thanks for the support. And, yeah, tell everyone to go and see it opening weekend.
We absolutely will. All right. See you later.
Excellent.
Stephen.
Thanks, mate.
All right, bye.
Bye.
You asked me to look after things, and I have done what you asked.
Things are different now. Things are different out here now. Not when I'm involved.
You listen to me. We've worked too hard to get to where we are. We're not giving that up.
Kill the president and do it so the men can see it.
I'm the president, me! You are with me or you're not!
You are not the sort of man that walks away from anything.
Kill him.